This is Ron Orl, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited today to be speaking with Stephen Brown, who is a senior advisor and managing director at KPMG Board Leadership Center, where he advises business leaders on key leadership and governance challenges. The NACD, the National Association of Corporate Directors, named Stephen one of the 100 most influential people in corporate governance and the boardroom. And before KPMG, Stephen led TIA's corporate governance group, which managed the corporate governance and social responsibility initiatives leading to the firm's over $1 trillion investment portfolio. And before TIA, Stephen practiced law, securities law at WilmerHale and Skadden. I was just speaking with Brian Branny at Skadden just before we started this. Thanks, Stephen, for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. And Brian's certainly a friend and an excellent person to have on your podcast. So to follow him, I feel honored.
No, I mean, I would just speak to him for an article, but you're right. I should have him on a podcast. And I think he would like to be on a podcast. So I will suggest it to him later on. But okay. So, Stephen, I'm excited to talk. We have the election and activism under the Trump administration. And I wanted to get your thoughts. Broadly speaking, I'm wondering if you think that with the incoming policies, when you're considering antitrust and in other areas, the SEC, whether all of that will bolster shareholder activism. And I'm wondering if you think there's an expectation that we might see more deals in a Trump administration, perhaps with a looser antitrust policy. And if we do see more deals, or even if we don't see more deals, will we see more M&A activism? Mm-hmm. And if we do see more M&A activism, what kind of M&A activism? You know, there's a variety of different kinds of M&A activism. What kind of M&A activism do you think we might see?
Well, I think the answer is both it depends and yes. What I mean by that is, you know, activism and M&A activity depends on the market environment. And I think the market is sort of poised for greater activity. Part of that is how do activists, those who are implementing M&A, think the response would be from both the shareholder community, the people who actually vote on directors, and from regulators. And on the, let me just take the regulation part, which I think, and again, it's, I don't think it's a secret, but with the new administration, who we believe will be less restrictive around antitrust, and which I think will further the type of M&A activism of selling companies or mergers or looking for breakups because of the environment will be right. So I think that will increase. Look, we're in an era of, let's say for the past 10 years, 10, 15 years, the idea of shareholder activism is not only a known thing, it is not rejected out of hand by large institutional investors. There will some who say that the large institutional investors are very close to activists. I think we will see that going forward. And so I think these are very good times for people involved in this space, whether they're service providers, law firms, accounting firms, advisory firms, in this space, and they're really looking for the new administration to sort of usher in this period of deal making. And I think people are ramping up.
So, I mean, if we see more deal making, maybe I just want to kind of dig down a little bit. What kind of activism, M&A activism, might we see more of? You mentioned divestitures and spinoffs. Do you think activists will get in the middle of existing mergers and try to block them or make changes? Do you think we might see more just sell the company outright?
No, Ron, great questions, which again, I don't have a crystal ball. So I'm being very cautious in prognosticating that. But what I do feel very strongly is that because the activist market has been there and we're seeing it at its most mature, we have people who have been with activists for a while and they've done very well and they've formed their own funds. And the space where we are in 2025 going forward is that you have a lot of firms out there, a lot of activist firms who are thinking. They're thinking that. They're doing the work. And part of doing the work of thinking about what could happen is that they're always thinking about, is this viable or will it be blocked by the government? And I just think they have more ideas that they'll put out there and be pushing. And that's something that I think everyone is expecting and boards need to prepare for. This is certainly what we're talking about, boards, around thinking like an activist and thinking about what's your response when that white paper comes forward and how you're going to convince your institutional investors to back you, to back the company on what it thinks might be, you know, the opposite story of what they have, what the activist is pushing.
Fascinating. Okay, so we've been talking about kind of hedge fund activism and M&A and the Trump administration. And I want to shift gears. I mean, I'm still talking about the incoming Trump administration, but shift gears to kind of this other category of activists, which I call kind of the ESG shareholder proposal activists. And the Trump administration just nominated former Republican Commissioner Paul Atkins to lead the Securities and Exchange Commission. And last year, I was at an event in Delaware where Paul Atkins talked about how shareholder proposals under the Biden administration, I guess under the oversight of Gary Gensler, the outgoing chairman of the SEC, Atkins described the shareholder proposals under Gensler as being weaponized. And the SEC staff under Gensler was letting anything go on the proxy card, is the way Paul Atkins described it. So those comments suggest to me that he might be more restrictive on shareholder proposals, maybe see more of these no action requests from companies to have the proposals removed. Do you think we might see more restrictive prohibitions on proposals going on ballots? And then perhaps, you know, could the SEC even adopt rules making it even tougher? I know Jay Clayton tweaked the rules to make them a little tougher to do shareholder proposal. Jay Clayton was Trump administration 1.0. Paul Atkins is 2.0.
Well, first of all, those of us have been around like yourself, you know, has seen the SEC, when there's a change in administration, do these flips. And so you'll have all those proposals under Trump 1.0 that didn't make it quite into regulation or guidance, you're going to see them all come back. And those that the current SEC chair put on hold or reverse will be put right back. So, I mean, that's a given. And part of those I have to deal with trying to regulate the proxy advisors and the no action request process, which you're absolutely right, that was sort of pulled back. And there was a fair amount that would just have to go to the ballot that we've seen in the last 4 years. The real question is that, will we see tougher guidance than we've seen in the previous Republican administrations? Will we see actual legislation? So put regulation on the side, coming from Congress around these issues. That will be interesting. But I think there's, look, the comment that you mentioned that the incoming SEC nominee said about shareholder proposals, you know, obviously it's true. A tremendous amount of the corporate community has really had some angst over the number of shareholder proposals that are out there. So I think you'll see some activity there. I'll end it with this. These rules have been around since the 1940s. And ever since these rules were pronounced in the 1940s, the type of quote-unquote activists you've seen have been small activists, have been individuals. And as we fast forward 80 years, that hasn't changed. And, you know, we did see Clayton, of course, tighten, you know, who can give proposals and sort of raise the amount. Well, it's not necessarily the amount, but the, how long you have to hold. So it'll be interesting that we see some tightening there. But with the fights that we've seen over the last 10 years, we're going to see them again. It's just a question of when we see actual legislation from Congress. And so that will be an interest to look for.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like if we see a significant increase in restrictions on these 14A traditional shareholder proposals, are there other strategies or approaches that these ESG activists will turn to? I'm thinking like vote no campaigns against directors. I think you had suggested to me when we chatted before about the ESG activists maybe rely on hedge fund activists. And I was just listening to this ABA American Bar Association meeting where there was a lot of discussion about 14A4, which is a kind of do the proposal as if you're doing a proxy fight with a director contest, having your own separate proxy for the proposal, which we saw at News Corp with Starboard and we saw at Warrior Met Cole with the AFL-CIO. And I know those are more expensive than the 14A8 proposals, but I don't know. I'm just wondering if there's like other things that these ESG activists can do if their traditional route of the proposal process is not available to them.
Indeed. First of all, I think, you know, we should all recognize that in this evolution of corporate governance, what we've seen in the last 15 years is the rise of the institutional investor. Their vote matters. They were told back in the 80s under Reagan that your vote matters and you have to vote. which is why it's sort of interesting to sort of hear some of the comments recently, and we may see this again, that you don't have to vote. And we've seen, some of the proposed legislation that we saw under Trump 1.0 was, I don't really have to vote, but if you vote, you have to pass it through, that sort of thing. So that is to say, institutional investors are here. They use their vote. They have a fair amount of power. And if we see that restriction, what we do know is that over the last 10 years, institutional investors do recognize the power of the activist hedge fund to make change. Because what the institutional investor wants is their index, long-term holders. They can't sell you if they wanted to do it. If they're not an active fund, they can't sell you. They're looking for some type of change. And they have certain tools that are available to them. Using 14a8 and having hedge funds use the 14a4 process, be careful what you wish for, right? Is what I would say is my overall mantra about this, because institutional investors, they're going to produce their fiduciary duty. They're going to act on that. And part of doing that is voting. And if that vote means voting against directors, where they are today in 2025 is very different from when they were in 1995. They're just more apt and able by their own regulatory schemes to vote against directors than they were, 20 years ago. The other thing I will say is that restrictions on the process, what we might see ESG activists do, and again, activists with a small a, not the hedge funds right, per se. They've been very active in other organizations and pushing large institutional investors who themselves represent mom and pop. All your institutional investors that are running money for retail investors are using that pressure and using the pressure of looking at their own policies inside of these publicly traded asset managers and really pushing the issue of how are you expressing your stewardship? And so I think that we're going to see that continue. So all of this develops to the pressures that institutional investors have, which is, by the way, just more extant. We know how institutional investors act, why they annually put out how they voted. They annually put out how they think around issues. And that just wasn't there. So I'm being a little old school. That wasn't there 10 years ago. And I think the job of those who are in corporations has become easier because it's a lot more transparent of how the institutional investors behave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. There's all these policies that they have on their websites about how they vote. But I have to say, in this subject, the topic that you chatted about before, I remember where the environmental and social activism, even during the Biden administration, has kind of not gained the level of support that it did, let's say, in 2021. The last couple of years, seen kind of ESG shareholder proposal activism, the 14a8 ones, lots of proposals. Maybe that's part of the problem. Too many proposals, lots of proposals, but not as much support, particularly from the big three index funds. And I know that perhaps, they're more supportive of these things than they were 10, 20 years ago, but just recently there's been a dip. And I'm curious if you think that they could come back. It sounds like you're suggesting that the big index funds could come back and support these ESG activists through other strategies, if the 14a proposal process is limited or restricted. But also, I'm wondering what you think about the anti-woke, this is kind of new phenomenon, anti-woke shareholder proposal campaigns. They typically are getting very little support, but a lot of proposals got very little support at the beginning and slowly built up. So yeah, I guess ESG activism, how do you think that the index funds will support them in the future? I'm talking environmental and social. Sure. And then anti-woke.
Well, first, I think it's important to note, because so many more proposals were getting through the gate, that gate of the SEC, you saw large institutional shareholders back them at a smaller rate. And that's because some of these proposals in the past would not have gotten through. And what has been consistent is that your larger institutional investors have always, if we had to put a title to how they vote, conservative would be that title. And look, I know we live in an environment where we try to pin wokeism or anti-wokeism against whatever that the commenters may put towards that. But large institutional investors have always been conservative with their vote. And so they voted for ESG proposals when they saw it warranted. When the proposal numbers really jumped up because they weren't being stopped under the 14a8 process, you saw it go down. And so something tells me to sort of think about if we have fewer proposals because they're going to be sort of held up in a no action process or stopped, then the proposals that get through may be the ones that are worthy to reach the ballot. And if that's the case, they'll take serious considerations. So I think it's reasonable to think about the number of those proposals. If they go down, you may see large institutional investors not afraid to vote for it if they think it's warranted. The reason why they wouldn't vote for it is that they don't like the wording, or quite frankly, the large institutional investors have access that retail and small investors don't. So they're able to talk to the company. They feel the company has a good handle on an issue. They don't have to use this tool called the 14A8 vote. So it's sort of interesting how we look at that. And I know we look at these votes year to year and we measure it to previous years, but it's, you got to dig into the numbers to really see where people are. And that's what I like to sort of deal with boards, is thinking about, where's the investor sentiment? How do they feel about a particular issue? And how do they feel that you, the board, feel on a particular issue? And they will not use their negative vote. If they don't want to use their negative vote, send a message if they think you already have the message. And then your question on anti-woke.
Oh, yeah.
And look, I think we'll see these proposals going forward. They have not gotten a great deal of action, and they still won't. But as we think about how shill the proposals and those who present them have gone on, I think in a much longer time span, I look over the last 20 years, typically those who produce proposals and they do it serially, they typically get better in how they're written. So that's sort of the thing to look for. Will these be better written in the years to come? And if so, they might pick up a little bit of activity, but I mean, they've been soundly rejected. Again, you have stewardship teams that they're able to figure this stuff out, and they haven't been willing to vote for those.
Yeah, no, I saw like 2%, 3% support, but just constantly beating drum on those. I saw a report recently that Starbucks, which was the recipient of an ESG proxy fight this year, could face an anti-woke or anti-ESG activist in the not too distant future. So I'll be keeping an eye on that one and see, maybe we'll see a clash of pro-ESG and anti-ESG at Starbucks in 2025. I don't know.
Well, that's sort of the thing, you know, sort of, and I don't want to get too geekish about this 14A8 process, but many times it's a race to get your proposal in. And if you get a proposal that looks similar, then you have the company deciding whether they're going to go to the SEC to say that the second proposal that they received 3 days later than an anti-woke proposal looks the same and they want to reject. So it's a very interesting play there. But again, that's really inside baseball, nitty-gritty about the 14A8 process.
Okay, so I want to chat. You mentioned the proxy advisors, and they were a big target of Jay Clayton for Trump 1.0 at the SEC. And then the Gary Gensler regime rolled back those rules. The rules themselves, I don't know, it was hard to see how tough they were when they were just barely implemented and then removed. Mm-hmm. On some level, they weren't so restrictive. I mean, one provision I remember was when the ISS and Institutional Shelter Services and Glass Lewis, the two proxy advisors, distribute their report, they have to attach a response from the company to the report. And ISS Glass were upset that when your sell-side analyst sends you your report, they don't have to attach the company's comments about it at the bottom. But put it aside, you know, if it comes back, I wonder whether Paul Atkins could be even tougher on proxy advisors. But I spoke to Paul Atkins in 2014, where he suggested that somebody should sue a proxy advisor for, you know, if they see that there's an error in the calculation of the recommendation on say on pay for the executives. And he would like to see how that happens. I don't think anybody ever did, but he's been hostile to the proxy advisors. So I don't know. Do you think we might see some more restrictions on the big proxy advisors in 2025, 26?
I think we will, namely because they're easy targets. And when you're an easy target in politics, you better believe you're going to get the slings and arrows. And I say they're easy targets because, look, in the U.S., there's really only two of them. There's more than two, but they're two big ones. I don't want to get letters from the third one. Right, there are two. And so we'll see this fight. Now, I just always caution the corporate community. These are private enterprises that are paid by shareholders. They're in business because shareholders want them, need them, use them. but the fight is sort of a proxy on shareholders, that we're not going to beat up on the shareholder community, that says they're the people who vote on us, that they're our shareholders, but we'll beat up on the people who they've hired to use as third-party advisors, like the proxy advisors. Mm-hmm. And these are interesting fights, even the issue around the conflicts of interest.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just very cautious about that, because people could say the same thing about the different conflicts or interests that exist today around different issues around investment banking. And if you take that concept to its logical conclusion, if you're looking at conflicts in the proxy advisor community, there are conflicts other places, or potential conflicts. Definitely. And I think you would have to run through those. That said, let me end that question, that answer to this question of, and we saw the rollback under this administration. There was a rollback and we all survived the last 2.5 years, right? Mm. So, you know, and so we see the proxy war on proxies come back. I wouldn't say it's much to do about nothing, but I just think there's other energies that we could spend our time on.
Okay. So one of the things that we saw a lot of in 2024 was CEO succession campaigns, big battles to oust the CEO of the company. And I wonder whether this is maybe back to the very first question where maybe, you know, in the period immediate lead up to the election, maybe we saw less, a little bit less M&A, less M&A activism. And so what are you going to do? You're going to do operational CEO activism. But I feel like there's a broader issue that we're seeing a lot of activists try to oust CEOs. I mean, there's, you know, the South Elliott versus Southwest mm-hmm. is a good example of that. There's an ongoing battle between Mantle Ridge and Air Products where they want to oust an 80-year-old longtime CEO. But I think the issue really there is a lack of a visible succession planning process. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Will we see more CEO succession battles in 2025? Obviously, this one is going to continue until 2025. But I don't know. Will we see other companies face them as well?
Look, always in an activist campaign, they hit the front page because they're sexy fights, particularly if they're personal. And I think what we've seen, and you just mentioned some of the fights that we've seen about CEO succession, we'll see more of those. I will tell you, from a board's perspective, over the last couple of years, boards have really, really focused on CEO succession. Mm-hmm. If I think about, there's a national big global conference in the fall for directors, not held by us, held by a national organization. And if I think about the several breakout topics from cybersecurity to activism to CEO succession, those CEO succession and the talent ones were standing room only. People were really interested in hearing how others do succession, how they think around talent. So this is a really big issue that I've seen boards recently try to get smarter on. And so the job of CEO, I think, has never been busier, harder. There's so many things that you have to do in this environment. Boards are focused and they're ready. What we see from previous activist campaigns, boards are also, if they think they don't have the right person and they're being pushed, they'll make that change. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see this going forward, because that is part of what activists do. If they believe that there's not the right management, they'll put that up. And so it's not an easy time to be a CEO, but they get paid very well, and that's part of the job.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I feel like it's also whether you kind of telegraph a succession plan, like a good mm-hmm. success that you're looking for a new CEO or you have a plan in place. And I don't know, I feel like there's like always a few outliers that then the activists kind of latch on to those outliers. Disney was the other big example.
Right? Exactly.
Tiger is, you know, the succession planning problem.
We know how activism works, is that it's like a predator on the Serengeti. Like, you don't go after the strongest buck, you go after the weakest. And there are companies that potentially are weak because they have either long tenured leadership and the stock is down. You better believe that you're going to be targeted. And so I think what it calls for are boards to be very proactive in how they communicate to the market, well beyond what's required by their SEC regs, to tell their story and to tell it loud and clear about how they do see a succession. And they're not going to tell you who they have in the wings. You know, that's not appropriate. But shareholders are really, particularly institutional shareholders, we work on, I say we, because I used to be an institutional shareholder. Obviously, price, people we have full disclosure on, and that third P is process. And so, I want to know your processes. And that's where companies have been just not very strong on, is sort of identifying and talking about their processes. And I think they're going to have to do that when it comes to succession planning, so that the institutional shareholder has a good understanding that the board has a great process and that they understand who's in the wing for that CEO succession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Yeah, definitely something. Maybe if it's not publicly, you can provide some details about succession to institutional investors. So, okay, we are out of time, but we've had a fascinating discussion. You've been listening to the Activist Investor Today podcast with Ron Orl, and we've been talking to Stephen Brown, who's a senior advisor and managing director at KPMG's Board Leadership Center. Thanks, Stephen, for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. Take care.